Michelle Rhee is, without a doubt, America's best-known education reformer. Her new autobiography, Radical, Fighting to Put Students First, chronicles her upbringing as the daughter of Korean immigrants, her career trajectory from Teach for America Corps member to Chancellor of the District of Columbia Public Schools, and now as founder and CEO of the political advocacy group Students First. Today, we talk with Michelle Rhee about becoming Michelle Rhee, what she's learned over these last tumultuous years, and what she thinks the future holds for education reform in America. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, Michelle, you are not exactly an unknown figure, nor has your story been untold. You've been the subject of countless newspaper, magazine articles, and the subject of a book by Richard Whitmire, who joined our podcast to talk about it, The Bee Eater. And you're constantly in the forefront of the reform movement. So first, just basic question. What was it that made you want to write this book?
I'd say there were three major drivers of me wanting to write the book. The first was I wanted to just tell my story and ensure that people understood sort of how I came to the views on education and education reform that I have through just kind of my life and my experiences. The second reason I wrote it was for teachers, because I think that teachers oftentimes have a misunderstanding or misperception of what I believe in and that sort of thing. And so I wanted to be able to directly say to teachers, look, this is what I'm about and this is why. And I actually think I succeeded in that because lots of teachers that have read the book say, wow, that was not what I thought it was going to be. And I'd say the third is for parents. You know, ever since I left DC public schools, I have talked to parents across the country who are really frustrated by the experience that their kids are having in the traditional public school district. And they feel alone. They feel like it's them against the system and that there's nothing that they can do to fix it. And so what I wanted to do was kind of provide a roadmap for them and give them examples of other parents across the country, just, you know, everyday normal parents who kind of took up a cause and did something about it and advocated at a state level for their kids and actually got something done. So I think that just empowering parents with that knowledge and information was the last thing that kind of drove me.
Okay, good. Well, I really enjoyed learning more about your childhood, which is how the book starts. And is it fair to say, I don't think you used these words, but is it fair to say that you were the daughter of a tiger mother?
I think that it would be fair to say that I was the daughter of a tiger mother, yes. You know, the way that I was raised really had an impact on kind of how I view education still to this day, because my parents demanded excellence from us all the time. And, you know, they weren't about kind of patting us on the back for getting an A. I talk about it in the book more like, well, why didn't you get an A+? Why weren't you the best? And it's funny because it also has, you know, impacted how I raise my own kids. You know, I am a person who believes that we need to instill in our kids a competitive spirit. I don't think that we are doing our kids any favors by, you know, handing out trophies for participation and that sort of thing. And so I'm pretty hardcore about that. And recently I was, you know, reading a blog that somebody wrote about me and called me a tiger mom. And I was kind of laughing at it. My younger daughter walks in the room and she says, what are you laughing about? And I said, well, this person thinks that I'm a tiger mom. My kid looks at me and she goes, no, you're not a tiger mom. You're more like a gerbil mom. And I was like, okay, I guess I'm not as hardcore as people think.
Yes, the warm and fuzzy at home. It's interesting learning about your parents. There's a little bit of a yin and yang going on here, right? Tell us about your mom and your dad.
Yeah. So my dad is the most mellow guy on the face of the earth. He's, you know, friendly. He's warm. He can talk to anybody. Everybody loves my dad, and he's just a genuinely, you know, nice man. My mother is very hardcore. She is, you know, no nonsense. She's very straightforward. You know, when I said first that I was going to go leave Cornell when I graduated and go to join Teach for America and teach in the inner city, my mom said, oh, heck no. You know, we didn't spend all that money for you to go to an Ivy League college so that you could go, you know, teach somewhere. That's not the point. And she was very adamant about that. But my dad said, no, you know, absolutely. This is worthwhile. This is a worthwhile endeavor. You need to give back to the community. And luckily for me, in the Korean culture, what the husband says is what goes. So my dad, even though he was sort of the strong, silent type when he weighed in, it made a huge difference.
And that was interesting. I mean, they were definitely living as Koreans, right?
Yes.
I mean, they'd moved to the United States just a few years before you were born.
Yep.
And they very much wanted you to grow up in a Korean culture, which, among other things, meant that you had to take, you know, do the dishes and take care of your brothers.
Yeah.
Your brother got a bad grade once, and who did they blame?
Yeah, my brother in high school got a bad grade, and my mother grounded me for it. And that's what I said. I you know, because I grew up here, and so I was very Americanized. And, you know, she says, well, you're not allowed to go out anymore because your brother got a bad grade. And I was thinking, what? Like, in what world does that make any sense? But in her mind, it made perfect sense because I, as the older sister, was responsible for making sure that my younger sibling was successful. And, you know, I was definitely bitter because I would live in this world where I'm at school, right, traditional public schools, and I'm, you know, learning about things and boys and girls are equal and all that sort of stuff. And I would go home and my mother would say, no, you have to do all these chores. And I'd say, well, why don't Eric and Brian need to do those things? And she'd say, because they're boys. And so it was a completely different set of messages that I was getting.
Now, they sent you to Korea, right?
Yes.
When you were, what, in sixth grade?
When I was in after my sixth grade year, because my parents did not want me to be the Korean kid who did not know how to speak, read, and write Korean. They just always thought that was ridiculous. They felt like Korean kids need to know where they came from, what their culture was. So they did, they actually sent, but my brother, my older brother went after his sixth grade year as well. And it was fascinating because it was the first time that I wasn't a minority, right? I was used to being the only Asian kid in my class or in my school, what have you. And all of a sudden, you can sort of be anonymous because you look like everyone else. And in a lot of ways, that was a great experience for me to have. But it was also a great experience from the standpoint of, I always thought my mother was incredibly strict and very serious. And when I went to Korea and saw other Korean moms, I thought, well, my mom isn't so bad now looking at these other people.
And what was you spend some time in Korean schools.
Yeah.
And you get a glimpse at maybe why they are so high performing on these international exams and such, right?
It was a really eye-opening experience for me. There were, back then, you know, classrooms would have 70 kids in them. Every kid would sit in these rows of desks by height. They, you know, every morning you'd have to do these calisthenics out in the playground, which I found very bizarre. But the most interesting thing, and I think the most different thing, was that they would rank every kid, right? So that you know, 1 through 70, you knew where you were. Now, I happened to be number 70 because I was the Korean as a second language kid. But the entire, not only class and school, but kind of community was kind of focused and oriented around, well, how well is your kid doing in school? So if you were number 18, your mom was saying, well, by the end of this quarter, you got to be 16 or 15, you know, and if you were 5, you wanted to be 3. And you'd think that the only kid in the class that would be happy was the kid who was number 1. But that kid, honestly, was kind of the most miserable kid in the class because he's looking behind him going, oh my gosh, there's number 2, there's number 3, did really well on the test. Are they going to, you know, beat me? And I think that while I wouldn't necessarily advocate for that practice to be utilized here in the States, what it did do is show me, you know, that when an entire culture is focused on how well kids are doing in school, you know, it creates the kind of environment where the kids understand fully, like, this is the most important thing that I can be doing is getting a great education.
Now, let's step, though, and push on this a little bit. I mean, some people would argue, well, that's fine for getting those high test scores on the math and science exams, but it doesn't necessarily create people who go on to be innovative. You know, America, we are the ones with the Bill Gateses and with the Facebooks and with the Googles.
Right.
I mean, how do you react to that? I mean, do you think that is too hardcore, that focus on achievement and just one one score on a test?
So I do. I mean, look, when I was in Korea, I was able to sort of live that life firsthand. And then when I became the chancellor of the DC Public Schools, people from Korea would come all the time and say, well, what do you think about what's happening in Korea? And I'd say, well, the only experience that I had was when I was, you know, little. Yeah. And I said, but here's what I know. You have to have a balance, right? When there's too much of a focus on all of these things, it stresses the kids out and all that sort of stuff. And you may not be creating a dynamic with kids where they are going to be creative and innovative and that sort of thing. But at the same time, you know, in order to be really creative and innovative, you got to know how to read and write. Like, you have to know your basic skills. And I think it's fine for, you know, us in America to say, well, you know, we have more creative people. Look at Facebook and look at Google. Those were started by Americans. Right, but who are the engineers who are staffing Google and Facebook right now? I mean, if Facebook and Google are telling us that they can't find the people who have the skills to do the coding in their organizations here in this country, and they've got to look abroad, that should be telling us something as well.
Right. Okay, good. All right, so let's skip ahead a little bit in your life story. As you said, you decided to go to Teach for America. Yeah. Your mother is not happy with this idea, but your father says give it a, you know, go for it. So you show up in Baltimore.
Yep.
You have no assignment.
Yes.
Maybe because you're the Korean kid.
Yep.
African-American and Korean relationships have been difficult in many urban areas. But you finally end up in a second grade classroom.
Yes.
And you were just fantastic right from the start, right?
No. You know, I really struggled my first year. I was put in a classroom, and my school tracked kids by both behavior and academics. And so I had the lowest track of kids, and this group of kids had been together since kindergarten, and they knew, you know, how to whip each other up into a frenzy, how to push the buttons of the teachers, etc. There were 36 kids in my class, and it was really tough.
And this is one of the toughest schools in Baltimore, and you're talking about basically the toughest kids in that school.
Yeah, the toughest 8-year-olds.
But they're
in
only
that
eight.
School,
right? They're only eight. How hard can it be?
That's what I thought when I started. I was like, "They're 8-year-olds. How hard can teaching 8-year-olds be?" And I still to this day, have memories of just how stressed out I was that first year, because it was literally the most difficult thing I have ever done. And one of the things that I loved about the last few weeks as I've toured the country with the book is the number of teachers that I've talked to who read that chapter about my first year teaching. And one of them in Seattle said to me, I felt like I was reading my own journal. I mean, just captured the, you know, entire angst that you feel, that pit in your stomach and on Sundays and that sort of thing. And so, you know, I think that the experience of being a first-year teacher in a really tough environment is pretty much unlike anything else that you can imagine, and only people who have gone through that experience can really sort of relate to you. But it was one of the most difficult years of my life, if not the most difficult year of my life. But it was also the most impactful. I mean, it really did change and shape my entire professional career.
So you had no control over the class.
I had
basically
no control over
and
the
people
class.
Knew people got a reputation, oh, Miss Ree's class is the one that's out of control.
My kids would be walking down the hallway and they'd be, you know, wreaking havoc, and I knew that the other teachers were saying, there goes Ree's class. They didn't even have to look out the door. They just knew that's Ree's class.
And yet there'd be times when another teacher, or I think it was a librarian, would take over your class because you had a meeting, and you'd come back and the kids were behaving like angels.
Yes, silent. Probably the most memorable experience that I had, or really it was kind of it changed my whole outlook on things, was I had this little kid in my class named Tamika. Now, she was the tiniest little thing you could ever see. I mean, and cute, right? Mm-hmm. And looked innocent. But she would whip the entire class into a frenzy at a moment's notice. And she'd just go running around. And she would do this on a daily basis. And I could not control the kids when she was in the room. And so one day I got really tired and I didn't know what to do. So I asked another teacher if I could put to me in that classroom for a little while. She said, sure. So we had a relatively successful mm-hmm. morning, and I'm walking down the hallway to go pick Tamika up, and I'm looking through the small glass mm-hmm. opening in the doorway of this veteran teacher's classroom before I open the door, and there's Tamika looking angelic with her hands folded, and, you know, she's raising her arm to answer a question, and she's participating. And at that moment, I thought, oh my gosh, it is not her. It's me. Mm. Like, she can go into the classroom of another teacher and participate and be well behaved. That it, the problem is not with her. It's that I'm not creating the kind of environment mm-hmm. that is, you know, basically demanding that kind of behavior. And so it was really sort of a mind altering mm-hmm. experience in a lot of ways. Like, it's not them, it's me. I've got to figure out how to do this.
And you asked your class at one point, why are you so well behaved with the other teacher? Yeah. And what did they tell you?
And this little boy, who was actually one of my biggest troublemakers, looked me straight in the eye, because I was, you know, yelling at the top of my lungs, why is it that you can behave for her and you can't behave for me? And he looks at me and he goes, because she knows what she's doing. And I thought, gosh, that was clear as day, and not just clear as day to me. Mm. Clearly, the kids yeah. know that as well.
So, and by the way, all of us that have been teachers have had these similar experiences. I remember being told by some of my own student teaching that perhaps I should find a different profession, which I did. Those of us who can't teach become policy wonks. Okay, so, but then something happened. Something changed. You were able to turn it around.
Yeah. You know, I can't point to any one thing that I did. I was just a woman possessed, and I knew that I knew what I wanted to do. I knew kind of what kind of culture I wanted to create. I just didn't know exactly how to do it, and so I sort of started to just, what I say, throw spaghetti up against mm-hmm. the wall to see what would stick. And so I would read about all these different discipline systems, and I'd try one for a few days and see if it worked and see if it resonated with the kids and me, and if not, then I'd move to another one and another one. I'd do the same thing with things like seating arrangements and, you know, lesson plans and whatnot. And finally, around April of my first year of teaching, things started to turn around and I could actually tell the difference. And people would come into my classroom and say, okay, I can actually tell that things are getting better and that you're moving in the right direction.
Some of the people that were overseeing your teaching, I guess, from the university.
Yeah.
And in the fall, they were telling you you maybe wanted to get a different
right.
job. And by the spring, they were saying, yeah, there's something happening.
That's exactly
here.
Right.
So let's stop there, Michelle, because I think that is such, obviously, it was such a formative part of your career. And you've gone on in many different roles to talk about the importance of a teacher. And kind of no excuses. I mean, so is your belief from all of that that, hey, if with enough commitment and drive, that any teacher can do the same thing?
Well, I don't think that anybody can be a successful teacher, because what I know from coming from a family of teachers and then being a teacher, this is the hardest job that a person can have, and not everyone can do it. And that's why we have to ensure that only the most effective teachers are in the classroom every day and have the privilege of teaching our children. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that teaching is something that anybody, you know, just if you want to do mm-hmm. it, you can. I think it's much, much more difficult and complicated than that.
Right. And you could see, I mean, all, you know, you kind of foreshadow, you're through the story and you see your childhood, you know, this discipline that you learn growing up, you know, your tough parents, especially your mom, right? You know, these high expectations. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, excellent education and, mm-hmm. You know, private public school
yeah.
and then Cornell. And you say, okay, so Michelle Rhee was able to figure out mm-hmm. how to turn it around.
Right.
You know, but are there 3 million Michelle Rhees out there, one for each of our classroom? Are there even 300,000 or even 30,000? I mean, in other words, when you have been so focused in your career on the importance yeah. of teachers, do you think you did you overlearn your own lesson from your own life?
Well, here's what I'd say, because, I mean, it's a good question, right? So if we have 3.6 million public school teachers teachers in this country? Can we find 3.6 million of them who are truly outstanding and who are really highly effective? And my guess is I think we can, because the bottom line is, in order to find those people, we have to elevate the teaching profession. We have to make it into a profession that high achievers are going to want to go into and stay in, right? And right now, the teaching profession is such that, for example, when in a time of layoffs, we lay the newest teachers off first, regardless of whether you're great or not. And so for a young person who's trying to decide what they want to do for their career, you look at the teaching profession and say, well, I could go into that profession, and it doesn't matter how good I am. If I'm the newest person in the door, then I'm going to be the first one to get to get fired. And I may be twice as effective as the person next to me, but they're going to make twice as much of me because they've been there for their entire, you know, a lot longer than I have. That's not the kind of profession that is going to attract a lot of folks into it. You know, people, high achievers want to go into a profession where they know that their performance is going to be valued. So part of what we have to do is create the kind of environment where teachers are really valued and respected for the incredible work that they do every day. I think if we created that environment, would we be able to find, you know, more highly effective teachers who are willing to stay in the classroom? Absolutely.
Other people would say, look, but part of the problem here was, you know, you had almost no training before you went in, right? And you had very little support once you were there. So if we could provide much better teacher preparation in college or other programs and a lot more support or curriculum or technology, then you wouldn't have to be superhuman in order to make this work.
Well, what I would say is that I have seen teachers who were trained in the traditional sort of, you know, higher education, did 4 years of ed school, so struggled just as much as I did. And it's because in lots of ways, I don't know that anything can prepare you for sort of the reality of being in a really, really difficult school environment. You know, I did a little student teaching too, but there was another person in the classroom, that sort of thing. You know, having responsibility for your own classroom, that's something that is different. But at the end of the day, here's what I would say. For those folks who sort of think, well, there is no way that we can find 3.6 million really, really highly effective teachers, and so therefore we're gonna have to figure out how to run a system, you know, with maybe 2 million or something like that. What I would say is, do we have to run education in the way that we do it now, right? So instead of saying, well, we're going to have 2 million great ones and then we have to have 1.6 million and maybe not so good ones, maybe we should take the 2 million great ones and figure out, well, how can these folks actually share their knowledge and have impact over more kids? And you see some of the things that are going on now with kind of digital learning and whatnot, and it's really amazing. I mean, I've gotten to the point, I don't know how old your kids are now, but I've gotten to the point now where I can no longer help my older daughter with her math homework, right? I look at the stuff, I'm like, dang, I forgot how to do that. And so she watches, we watch together the Khan Academy videos. And I watch them. I'm like, these are friggin' brilliant. I mean, it just makes so much sense. And kids, she's watching it just like kids across the country are watching it. Yeah. And we're watching them and figuring out how to do that together. That has, I think, tremendous potential for how we can, if we were in a situation where we had, you know, a confined number of great teachers, how can those teachers have impact over more kids?
So much to cover in the book. Let's talk a little bit about your time in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
You come in, it's a dysfunctional system, so many things to do. And you put in a big focus on teacher quality. But one of the hardest things you have to do is you have to close a bunch of schools.
Yeah.
And this, of course, is we've seen this play out now in other cities as well. In Chicago, as we speak, is in the middle of a big, big debate about this. Tell us about how did that go and what lessons did you take from it?
So it was one of the early, most tumultuous experiences that we had in the reform movement here in D.C. And I can tell you that there is a reason why people in the district had chosen not to close schools before, because it is a very emotional and sentimental process. And so we got a tremendous amount of opposition and pushback to the school closure plan, where we had planned on closing 23 schools across the city, which was about 15% of the schools. And at that time, it was the largest single school closing that had ever happened across the country. And, you know, I think it was about 10 weeks of me out there every night going to multiple community meetings, getting yelled and screamed at. You know, it was clear from the sort of outrage that people had, et cetera, of why people had avoided this for so long in D.C.
And is that the reason? You know, you were hired, of course, by Adrian Fenty, right, who was this young mayor who'd been elected, pushed for mayoral control, got it, staked his whole career on improving D.C. public schools, and then lost.
Yeah.
And some people have said, well, that's because of the school reforms or because of Michelle Rhee.
Yeah. I would agree with that. You know, a lot of people say, well, it wasn't you, it was Fenty, his personality. And, you know, I'm not here to argue about Adrian's personality. But what I can tell you is this. The man was so courageous in the stand that he took on education reform. And you know, had he been the kind of politician that was always listening to the people whispering in his ear saying, don't let her do that, don't let her do that, then I couldn't have been as aggressive as I was. And at the end of the day, it is very clear to me that the narrative that was created of, oh, he doesn't listen, you know, he doesn't care about the poor black folks in the community, that sort of thing, it was a lot of that narrative was created because of the work that we were doing in D.C. and because of the way that people, you know, were perceiving it. And you know, nothing could be further than the truth. I mean, what Adrian wanted, what the mayor wanted was for D.C. to live up to its promise. You know, as the nation's capital, he felt that it should have the best school system in the country. And he was livid every day that we were failing our children and thought it was absolutely criminal and was willing to stake his entire political career on making the schools better. We need more of those politicians across the country now, if you ask me. And I think that too many of them take the opposite approach that Fenty did, which was they say, well, the world is a better place when I'm in office, so I have to do whatever I can to stay in office. And what Fenty's rationale was it won't be worth being in office and being a leader until I can solve this problem.
Though you all probably could have accomplished even more if he had won that reelection, right? And so
no doubt.
The question would be, you know, was there something that you or he could have done differently in terms of approach or style, still being just as aggressive on reform, that would have resulted in him winning re-election?
You know, the thing that Fenty said to me at the beginning, which I think was absolutely right, was he's like, look, we can't be dumb enough to believe that we're going to do things the same way that other people did. We're just going to be, you know, smarter, faster, cuter, and because of that, we're going to be successful. We have to chart a different course. Mm-hmm. And through that different course, you know, hopefully people will learn different things. And that's my point. I mean, I can't play Monday morning quarterback and say, if only we'd done this instead of this, he would have been reelected. Yeah. What I hope people will take out of this is we did a lot of good things and we made a lot of mistakes. And what I would hope is that the next mayor and superintendent who come along who want to also take on aggressive reforms can look at what we did and say, okay, I'm going to do the great things that they did, where they made the mistakes, we're going to make some tweaks and see if we can find a better path.
Yeah, tell me, I mean, so what were those? I mean, can you be specific on the mistakes or the tweaks you would make?
I mean, I made mistakes literally every day, right? But here are a few of the, I'd say if I had to categorize the mistakes that we made into one category, it would be around communication, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought my job was to run the school districts and manage the schools every day, et cetera. I was not thinking at all about communications and PR, right? Yeah. So when I did things like, you know, laid teachers off by quality instead of seniority, I thought it was obvious. Mm-hmm. Of course, we want to keep the great teachers in the classroom. Of course, people are going to understand why I'm doing this. And so I would just do it. And I wasn't thinking about, okay, how do I message this to the community, right? Mm-hmm. How do I go on a PR blitz to make people understand what we're doing and why we're doing it? I just thought it was kind of common sense. Right. But I was wrong. Mm-hmm. And so the people who were opposing what we were doing would go out and say, well, you know, she's trying to get rid of veteran teachers because they're more expensive, you know, so they had created a narrative. Right. And because I wasn't out there pushing my own narrative, their narrative sort of just became fact and people said, that's my fault. right? Yeah. That was because we were not thinking about this kind of as a campaign, right? Mm-hmm. As a, you know, you constantly have to be out there as the messenger sending those messages,
right,
and
framing the debate.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that was just, I mean, that was naivete on my side.
I think the word that appears in this book more than any other word is rage.
You know, somebody asked me about this the other day, because they were asking me a bunch of questions about school reform, and I was getting really heated, which half the time I don't even realize that this is happening, and they're like, wow, you feel really passionately about this. And this is the thing, I do. I mean, I, for as difficult as this job in D.C. was, and for as much kind of pushback as I got, I loved it. I mean, it was the best job that I could imagine having, because I'd be out in the schools every day and I saw what was happening to our children. And it was absolutely heartbreaking to know that our children, who had so much potential, so much aptitude, were being done a disservice because we were not providing them with a high quality education in every single classroom. Not that it wasn't happening in places. There were certainly teachers in the city who were doing amazing things, but we weren't doing it on a consistent basis. And when I looked in the eyes of those kids, they just deserve so much more. And their shot in life, right, their life outcomes, their life chances are going to be dependent on how well we are doing in their schools every day. And if we're not doing our jobs, then tomorrow they're not going to have a job. And so I didn't have any tolerance and I didn't have any patience for the people who said, you need to slow down, you need to bring people along with you, because I look at those people and say, well, that's easy for you to say because you have your kid tucked up in a Tony private school somewhere. These children, our children every day, are dependent on whether or not we are moving fast enough. And so in my mind, there is no way that you can move too fast in providing them a great education. So I do feel a tremendous amount of rage around what I feel is the real criminal disservice that is happening to kids in schools across this country today. And quite frankly, I don't think that there is anything that is more worth fighting for and be getting angry about than the future of our kids.
All right. Well, we only scratched the surface of this book. Again, it's Michelle Rhee, Radical, Fighting to Put Students First. Michelle, thanks so much for joining the podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterum. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.